One, what you're going to hear tonight, philosophy and theology, argument, tough thought. Stage two, a novel, Till We Have Faces, the best book C.S. Lewis ever wrote. That is the best written book, the most brilliant book, magnificent novel. Three, deepest of all, autobiography, the journal that he kept when his wife died, A Grief Observed. The movie Shadowlands was largely based on that. So this is just the beginning. The problem is not just why do we suffer. The problem is, if Christianity is true, why do we suffer? Lewis says, Christianity is not the conclusion of a philosophical debate on the origins of the universe. It is a catastrophic historical event. It is not a system into which we have to fit the awkward fact of pain. It itself is one of the awkward facts which have to be fitted into any system we make. In a sense, it creates the problem of pain. For pain would not be an intellectual problem unless, side by side with our daily experience of this painful world, we had received what we think a good assurance that ultimate reality is righteous and loving. So the problem is not just pain. The problem is a loving God and pain. That's the only strong argument for atheism. When Thomas Aquinas writes the Summa Theologica, he writes 4,000 pages of carefully reasoned argumentation, and he always tries to be utterly fair to his opponent. So he always lists all the objections from the opponent on every one of the thousands and thousands of questions that he deals with. And three is the minimum number for objections. Every other article has at least three objections to it, except the most important article in the whole book, the first one, the existence of God. If there is no God, there's no theology. So that's question one. He can find only two arguments against the existence of God in the whole history of human thought. And one of them doesn't even claim to prove that there is no God. It's just the argument from the natural sciences, which say, well, science can't prove that there is a God, so it's an extra. That doesn't prove there isn't any. The only argument that even claims to prove logically that there is no God is the problem of evil, the problem of suffering, the problem of pain. So this is the biggie. And this is the best book I know on this biggie. I don't know a better book that is a more adequate book, a more satisfying book on the purely intellectual level than this. But it's only on the intellectual level. He says in the preface, the only purpose of this book is to solve the intellectual problem raised by suffering. For the far higher task of teaching fortitude and patience, I was never fool enough to think myself qualified. Nor have I anything to offer my readers except my conviction that when pain is to be borne, a little courage helps more than much knowledge, a little human sympathy more than much courage, and the least bit of the love of God more than all. So don't expect from the book more than it claims. There are four kinds of books. Some books are clear at first reading and clear upon subsequent readings. Those are simple books. A second kind of book, they're clear upon first reading, and then upon second reading, you begin to notice problems, and the more questions you ask, the more confused you get, and the book turns out to be really unclear. Deep down, it's really shallow. Third kind of book, it's unclear on first reading, and on second reading, and on third reading. It's just either much too difficult and above your head forever and ever, or it's just muddled and confused. The fourth kind of book is the best one. Almost all the classics are this kind. They're unclear on first reading, clearer on second reading, clearer on third reading, and every single time you reread the book, it becomes clearer and clearer. I think all the classics are like that. Now, sometimes you come to an end and you say, I understand everything in the book. A book like Euclid's Geometry. I remember when I was in high school, I went through three copies of Euclid's Geometry because I killed two of them. I was so mad at myself for not understanding. I threw the book at the wall and the spine cracked twice. But eventually I got it. You can do that with the hard sciences and math, but you can't do that with philosophy and theology. A great book you never come to the end of. A great book is one that's like a great person. You never get bored with them. Every time you meet them, you find something new. I think this is a great book. Nobody, except a genius, understands everything in this book with total clarity the first time they read it. Maybe C.S. Lewis did. I saw the first draft of the manuscript that he used to write The Problem of Pain at the Wade Center in Wheaton College in Illinois. And it's amazing. It's written in hand script. Lewis didn't type. But it has almost no revisions in it. He simply wrote it in order as it appears here, sentence by sentence, word by word. And the first time he wrote it, the whole thing came out. Now, I don't know of anybody who reads it that way. I must have read it 10 times. And I just read it one more time in preparation for this, and I got exactly the same experience this time as I got each of the other 9 times. Namely, gee, how come I didn't see that the first time? It's a little book, but it's amazing how chock full it is. So please don't feel bad about yourself if the first attempt has produced only, well, 10% of this I understand, 90% of it I don't understand. Don't throw it away. Read it a second time, and then it'll be 20%, and the third time it'll be 30%. It's worth it. The intent of this book is not to be something original. In Mere Christianity, Lewis says the secret of originality is not to try to be original. Try to be original and just to make a fool of yourself. Try to impress somebody and you'll make a fool of yourself. Try to be desperately creative and you'll make a fool of yourself. Forget about yourself. Just tell the truth as you see it and you'll be original without trying. That's his purpose in this book. He says, except in the last 2 chapters, which are about heaven and about animal pain, 2 interesting postscripts, except in the last 2 chapters, parts of which are admittedly speculative, I have believed myself to be restating ancient and orthodox doctrines. If any parts of this book are original, in the sense of being novel, they are so against my will. This is a synthesis of the best that Christian thought has achieved for 2,000 years on the subject. Lewis had an amazing memory. He remembered everything he read, and he read almost everything written. So it's all in here. He begins in the introduction with a kind of argument for Christianity, which isn't really part of the solution, but part of the problem. Because, as he said in that paragraph I quoted a moment ago, unless you had assurance that God was as loving as Christianity says he is, the problem of pain wouldn't be such a scandal. So why be a Christian? Lewis answered that question in many different ways, in many different parts of his writings. But here, he takes you on a wonderfully organized tour of history and traces 4 steps of the religious development of humanity, or 4 steps in the revelation of God. I summarized them very briefly in reading a couple of sentences from Mere Christianity last night, but they're basically the sense of worship and wonder and transcendence and the numinous that God just left in the human imagination and results in all the myths in paganism. 2, conscience, which retains some knowledge of what God wills for us, even when God himself is not known. Everybody's got it. Those are the 2 Paul mentions in Romans. The wonder at nature and its greatness and its creator, and the realization that conscience makes absolute demands. Then 3, the Jews, the miracle of this historical people that are different than everybody else and survived miraculously and have a knowledge of God that nobody else has. And then finally, among these Jews, a man appears who claims to be God. And if you follow these 4 steps, then you've got the problem of pain. He states the problem in about as simple and short a way as you could state it. If God were good, he would wish to make his creatures perfectly happy. If God were almighty, he would be able to do whatever he wished. But we, his creatures, are not perfectly happy. Therefore, God lacks either goodness or power or both. That is a very clear and powerful argument. It looks on the face of things unanswerable. We believe that God is real, all good, all powerful, all loving, and all wise. Then how come we're so miserable? This is the problem of pain in its simplest form. The possibility of answering it depends on showing that. Now, here's a strategy. There's three ways to answer any argument. Let me give you a little logic lesson in 1 minute. An argument is a series of propositions or statements or sentences that tries to prove a conclusion from certain premises. And both the premises and the conclusion are sentences which have subjects and predicates in them. They're either true or false. And the subjects and predicates mean something. So the three ingredients of any argument are the terms that mean something, the sentences that are either true or false, and the logic of the argument which claims to prove the conclusion. So the three things that can go wrong with any argument are, number one, the terms may be ambiguous. Their meaning may not be clear or may be misunderstood. Secondly, the premises may be false. You can prove anything from false premises. Thirdly, the logic may not be tight enough. You may not really prove the conclusion. Well, the logic of this argument is very tight, and the premises certainly seem to be true, that God is good and God is almighty. So, Lewis says, the possibility of answering it depends on showing that the terms, all good and all powerful, and perhaps also the term happy, are ambiguous. For it must be admitted from the outset that if the popular meanings attached to these words are the only possible meanings, the argument is unanswerable. So, first he explores what we mean by saying God is omnipotent. Then he explores what we mean by saying God is all good. Then he explores what we mean when we say we are not happy and why. Those are the three parts to the argument. This is good technique. Any scientist has to explore the data and become very familiar with the data before he can be confident that he's got any explanation for it. Now, here's our data. When St. Augustine writes a great book on the problem of predestination and free will, he calls it On Grace and Free Will. He believes in both. He starts by stating the problem as hard as he can, as honest as he can. Our choices, are we the first cause or is God the first cause? If we're the first cause, we're free, but we're not predestined. If God's the first cause, we're predestined, but not free. How can we be both? Very hard question. Instead of coming up with a quick answer to it, he explores the data. What's freedom mean? Is freedom a kind of neutral thing where you stand suspended in the middle of nowhere? Or is freedom the choice to get to where you're supposed to be, your end, your destiny, which is in God? Isn't that the deepest freedom, liberty? And God's grace, God's sovereignty, God's predestination, how does that work? Does it work from outside like a tyrant, or does it work from inside? Does it fulfill you rather than tyrannizing you? Is he your interior master rather than your external master? And by deepening those two terms, he finally comes up at the end of the book with the fact that you don't need to solve the problem. It's dissolved. You see the two things as two sides of the same coin. Your true liberty is precisely in conforming precisely to God's predestination. And his predestination consists in predestining you to be liberated. Well, that's a good method. And Lewis uses that method too. So almost all of the book is exploring the meaning of three terms: power, goodness, and happiness. First, what do we mean when we say God is all-powerful? Omnipotence, he says, means power to do all that is possible, but not to do the intrinsically impossible. You may attribute miracles to God, but not nonsense. There is no limit to his power. But if you choose to say, God can give his creatures free will and at the same time withhold free will from them, you have not said anything about God at all. Meaningless combinations of words do not suddenly acquire meaning simply because we add to them two other words, God can. If I could do miracles, I could walk through a wall. But even if I could do miracles, I couldn't both walk through a wall and not walk through a wall at the same time. That's meaningless. So, if God chose to give us free choice, he could not at the same time take it away and force us to choose him. It's one or the other. He either creates beings like the plants and the animals that are innocent and cannot sin because they have no choice, or else he creates beings like us and the angels who have the freedom of choice. And if they have the freedom of choice, then they have the freedom of choice. And that means they can choose either way. And either way means they can choose against God too. And if that is the origin of all evil, well, then evil is possible. Notice, Lewis is not trying to prove that God was right in doing this. He thinks that can't be done. We don't have the standards to judge God. You might think, God made a mistake in creating us. It's too irresponsible. He should have just created nice, innocent children and left them in the Garden of Eden and never let the snake in the grass. Well, that's another argument entirely. No one can prove that. But once you accept the fact that you're here, once you're glad that you're here, once you say to God, thank you that I exist, thank you for creating me as a human being with free will, then you can't complain that God is not exercising his omnipotence in ruling the world so perfectly as to eradicate all evil. He can't do that. Just as he can't make a rock bigger than he can lift. That's a silly old question that atheists often throw at theists. Ha, I'll prove there's no God. Look, can God make a rock bigger than he can lift or not? If you say no, he's not omnipotent. If you say yes, he's not omnipotent because there's something bigger than God can do. Therefore, there's no God. Silly argument. There is no such thing as a rock bigger than God can lift. That's a meaningless combination of words. That's like saying, can God squiggle, squabble, squoovle? If you say yes or no, you got it. Meaningless. Now, the usual argument then proceeds very simply to say, so God decided to give us free will. We used it badly. We sinned. Sin came into the world. And that's our fault, not God's. That's perfectly right. That's the simple approach of Genesis. After chapter 1 and 2, where the totally good God with total omnipotence creates a totally good universe, and after each of the day's work of creation, including making us, he says, good, good, good. The reader looks at that and says, yeah, but what about evil? So the writer next goes into chapter 3, which explains the origin of evil. The good creature chooses evil. The question, what would motivate a perfectly innocent Adam and Eve to choose evil rather than good, is a very mysterious question. And we don't have a totally clear answer to that question, we just got some hints. But at least the author of Genesis gets God off the hook. That is, evil came into the world not because God is evil, and not because anything God created is evil. God is totally good. In him there is no darkness at all. He is pure light. And everything he created is good because he said so. So evil's not a thing. Evil's not stuff. It's not dark stuff that fights with bright stuff. It's not stuff at all. All stuff is good. It's wrong choices. And he didn't do it. We did it. All right. That makes sense. The usual problem then is, okay, that explains sin. Or moral evil. What about physical evil? What about pain? It's easy to get God off the hook for sin. God didn't sin, we did. But what about pain? What about physical evil? The stock answer, which I think is quite profoundly right, is that we are not just spiritual creatures and we are not just physical creatures. We are at the same time physical and spiritual. Our body and our soul is not two things like a captain in a ship or an angel in a machine. There are two dimensions of one thing, like the words in this book and the meaning in this book. If you change one, you're going to change the other. I can't alter the words of this without altering the meaning. And the only way for me to alter the meaning is to alter the words. So my body is like the words, and my soul is like the meaning. So when my soul falls into evil by sin, my body necessarily also falls with it into pain and suffering and death. And Lewis says something like that too. And that's a good answer. But he goes further. He says, in order for us to exercise our free will, we have to live in a world that we can make choices about. To have free choice is to choose about something or other. Now, if we're sinners and we have wills that aren't conformed to God's will, we're not going to be in harmony with each other either, and there's going to be competition. The thing that's convenient for me is inconvenient for you, if there's a thing there. So once God creates a material world and free souls, and they fall into sin, there's going to be pain. That's fairly simple so far. Well, the next chapter is about divine goodness. God is totally good. But a human being who's totally good wouldn't even allow, much less do, the evil that God allows. Granted, God doesn't do it, but he allows it. That's very clear from the book of Job. You start in the book of Job with this picture of Job as perfectly good and perfectly happy and as perfectly just. Good guys get rewarded. He's sitting there at the city gates, dressed in white robes, with a smile on his face, dispensing justice and telling people how good God is. And then God comes to him and says, hey, Job, how would you like to change your story? How would you like to be in Job 2? I've written the script for you. And if he had shown Job the script, I don't think Job would have liked it very much. So he doesn't show Job the script. He allows the devil to impose it on Job. Now, granted, God doesn't do evil, but God allows it. The devil has to come to God and ask permission. Pretty please, may I torture Job? And God says, well, sort of. You can touch his possessions, but not his body. He tortures Job. Job passes the test. The devil comes back to God and says, yeah, he passed the first test, but he wouldn't pass the second one. Let me torture his body. And God says, okay, you can torture his body, but don't kill him. Notice the devil doesn't say, let me force his soul into evil. Nobody can do that to you, not even the devil. It's you who are responsible for your own sins. So he does, and Job passes that test too. The point is that God does have control. Only by God's permission does evil happen. God doesn't do it, he doesn't want it, but he permits it. He could have stopped it. He could have miraculously stopped it, but he didn't. So there's a natural and honest question, would a good God do that? If I'm sitting on my front porch and I see my little infant run out into the street and I see an 18-wheeler coming down the street and I don't run out into the street as fast as I can to save my infant but just sit there and let him get run over, I'm not a good father. God does something like that. He lets terrible things happen. He could miraculously intervene and into our streets and pick us up. He doesn't do it. I don't know if you saw the movie The Passion by Mel Gibson. Not a movie, it's an experience. You'll be knocked down and out at it. But there's a wonderful scene where Jesus is falling down under the cross time and time again on the way to Calvary. And his mother is remembering a scene when Jesus was a little baby. And he's a toddler. And he's walking down the road and he falls and he hurts himself. And Mary goes and picks him up and cuddles him and kisses away his boo-boos. She can't do that now. But God can, and he doesn't do it. So that's a very serious problem. How does Lewis answer it? By the goodness of God, we mean chiefly his lovingness, and in this we may be right. But by love, most of us mean kindness, the desire to see others happy, just happy. What we would really like would be a God who said of anything we happen to like doing, what does it matter as long as they are content? We want, in fact, not a father in heaven, but a grandfather in heaven. A senile benevolence who, as they say, liked to see the young people enjoying themselves, and whose plan for the universe was simply that it might be truly said at the end of each day, a good time was had by all. Not many people, I admit, would formulate a theology in precisely those terms, but a conception not very different lurks at the back of many minds. I do not claim to be an exception. I should very much like to live in a universe which is governed on such lines. Let's be honest. Wouldn't you? But since it is abundantly clear that I do not live in such a universe, and since I have reason to believe, nevertheless, that God is love, I conclude that my conception of love must need correction. Now, there's some wisdom for you. It's your concept of love that you use in trying to explain God. Why not do the opposite? Why not question not God with your concept of love, but question what you know about love through God's eyes? And if you do, what comes out? Well, what comes out, that kindness is a part of love, but not the whole part, not all of it. You're kind to strangers. People you love more, you're more than kind to. If some stranger comes to you and says, life is meaningless to me, I think I'm going to just forget it and scramble my brains with drugs, you probably say to him, I think you're making a really stupid mistake. And he said, I don't care. I'm gone. I'm out of here. You never saw him before. You will never see him again. You worry, you pray for him, but it doesn't get you all messed up inside. If your son or daughter comes to you and says that, how different it is. What do? You do everything. Sacrifice your life for them. You shout and scream. You're kind to strangers. You're kind to animals. When they suffer, what do? Kill them. Put them out of your misery. Well, shouldn't you do that to human beings? Of course not. Love is more than kindness. Oh. It's more mysterious than kindness. Kindness is very clear. Everybody has a desire for pleasure and a fear of pain, and we all understand exactly what that means. But we also have other desires, desires for goodness and honor and holiness and perfection and all sorts of mysterious things. And if we desire for others what we desire for ourselves, then we desire more than just pleasure. And those mysterious desires, those aren't too clear. So if God, who designed all those desires and our love for them, if God truly loves us, the whole of us and the best of us, then his love is bound to be mysterious. And sometimes the lower good has to be sacrificed for the higher good. You've ever been to a dentist? Then comes the third and longest part of the book, human happiness and how human wickedness impedes it and what God can do about it. Lewis uses a lot of human analogies, and in the chapter on divine love, he uses the scriptural analogies of a father's love for children and a potter's love for the vessel and a pet owner's love for the pet and above all a man's love for his wife. And he says, the examples given in the last chapter went to show that love may cause pain to its object, but only if that object needs alteration to become fully lovable. Love does not reconcile itself to imperfection. The more you love someone, the more idealistic you are about them. Okay, but why do we need so much alteration? There's a line I'm going to quote tomorrow in Lewis's diary, A Grief Observed. He finally comes to the point after the agony of his wife's painful, quick, early death, and working through the pain, when he says, well, I'm going to make a choice. Either I need this or not. And if not, God's not good. So I guess I need it. I don't see how, but I guess I do. That's the either or. The Christian answer, why do we need so much alteration, is that we have used our free will to become very bad. This doctrine is well known, and it hardly needs to be stated, but to bring this doctrine into real life in the minds of modern men, and even modern Christians, is very hard. When the apostles preached, they could assume, even in their pagan hearers, a real consciousness of deserving divine anger. It was against this background that the gospel appeared as good news. It brought news of possible healing to men who knew that they were mortally ill. But all this has changed. Christianity now has to preach the diagnosis, which is in itself very bad news, before it can win a hearing for the good news. Which is one of the reasons why Christianity is so unpopular in modern-day America. Because it makes no sense at all unless there's a problem. Jesus is the Savior. From what? Poverty? Ignorance? Voting for the wrong candidate? No, sin. Sin, what's that? That's not a nice word. So you have to preach the bad news before the good news makes any sense. So Lewis writes a chapter defending the idea of sin. There's a lot of good stuff in it. I'll just quote the last paragraph. By the way, this book, hard as it is made easier by the fact that the first and last paragraph of each chapter summarizes the argument. Is a kind of roadmap. I believe sin to be a fact, and I notice that the holier a man is, the more fully he is aware of that fact. Who's the authority on how good we are? Bad people or good people? Good people. Just as who's the authority on how sober you are? Drunks or the sober people? Sober people. All right? So ask the saints how good we are. You'll get the same answer. We're all sinners. St. Paul called himself the chief of sinners. Perhaps you have imagined that this humility in the saints is a pious illusion at which God smiles. This is a most dangerous error, for it makes you identify a virtue, that is a perfection, with an illusion, that is an imperfection. If the holier you are, the stupider you are about yourself, then don't be holy. All right, so we're sinners. And we need a lot of alteration that we don't understand. Next question. How did this state of affairs come about? If God is good and he created us good, how did we fall? In the next chapter, I will give as much as I can to understand the Christian answer to that question. So he's got a chapter on the fall of man. A very interesting chapter. But sort of an extra, so I won't go into it deeply. Just, again, read the last paragraph. The point of this chapter is simply that man as a species spoiled himself, and that good to us in our present fallen state must therefore mean remedial or corrective good. We're broken, we've got to be restored. What part pain plays in such a remedy or correction now has to be considered. So divine providence is not just God has a great plan for your life. Divine providence is God is straightening you out. Here's a line that's quoted twice in the movie Shadowlands. God whispers to us in our pleasures, speaks to us in our conscience, but shouts in our pains. It is his megaphone to rouse a deaf world. A bad man who is happy is a man without any inkling that his actions do not answer, that they are not in accord with the laws of the universe. A perception of this truth lies at the back of the universal human feeling that bad men ought to suffer. It's not just vengeance. It's not even just justice. It's charity. We need truth. And if you're bad and you don't know that, then it's not charity to have that illusion fostered. Even hell is truth, known too late. That's one use of pain. He says, if the first operation of pain shatters the illusion that all is well with us, the second shatters another illusion, namely that what we have in this world, however good it is, the illusion that what we have is our own and enough for us. We have all noticed how hard it is to turn our thoughts to God when everything is going well. We have all that we want. This is a terrible saying when all does not include God. As St. Augustine says somewhere, God wants to give us a great gift, but he cannot because our hands are full. There is nowhere for him to put it. Or as a friend of mine said, we regard God as a pilot regards his parachute. It's there for emergencies, but he hopes he'll never have to use it. Now, God, who has made us, knows what we are and knows that our happiness lies in him alone. Yet we will not seek it in him alone as long as he leaves us any other resort where it can even plausibly be looked for. Now, you might say at this point, this doesn't make sense. If God is supreme joy, then why would we desperately look this way and that like hunters eager to escape a man-eating tiger and take refuge in all sorts of idols when the true God, whom we know is our true joy, offers us himself? And the answer is because we're nuts. That's the result of the fall. While what we call our own life remains agreeable to us, we will not surrender it to him. But he made us so that that is the only way to our happiness. What then can God do in our own best interest but make our own life less agreeable to us and take away these plausible sources of false happiness? It is just here where God's providence seems at first to be the most cruel that the divine humility most deserves praise in stooping down. We are perplexed to see misfortune falling upon decent, inoffensive, worthy people. How can I say with sufficient tenderness what here needs to be said? Let me just implore the reader to try to believe, if only for the moment, that God, who made these deserving people, may really be right when he says that their modest worldly prosperity and even the happiness of their children is not enough to make them fully blessed, and that all this must fall from them in the end. The supreme example is death. It applies to all of us. No matter how good your life is, it's got to fall from you in the end. There are a lot of little asides, little pieces of wisdom in these chapters. It's not a systematic know-it-all, give you all the answers thing. It's, oh, that's good, that helps a lot. And here's one of them. The Christian doctrine of suffering, I believe, explains a very curious fact about the world we live in. The settled happiness and security, which we all naturally desire, God withholds from us by the very nature of the world. Any one of us might fall into death, suffering, a horrible accident, a tragedy at any moment, tonight. But joy, pleasure, and merriment, he has scattered broadcast. We are never safe, but we have plenty of fun and even some ecstasy. Why? I think it is not hard to see why. The security we crave would teach us to rest our hearts in this world and make it very hard to return to God. But a few moments of happy love or a landscape or a symphony or a merry meeting with our friends or a bath or a football game have no such tendency. Our Father refreshes us on the journey with some very pleasant inns, but will not encourage us to mistake them for home. A lot of practical wisdom there. I think the three best chapters in the book are the last three, which are really postscripts. One about hell, which is the supreme problem of evil, one about heaven, which is the supreme good, and one about a topic that in his own day, Lewis was almost the only theologian in the world that thought very seriously about, namely animal pain. There's a lot of people today that are talking very seriously about animal rights, and they worry sometimes more about animals than about people. But in his own day, Lewis was thought to be rather sentimental for thinking very seriously about the pains of animals. But he said some very reasonable things about it. I'm not going to spend much time on it. In fact, let me just very briefly read two sentences from the chapter on animal pain. He says, the problem of animal suffering is appalling, not because the animals are so great or numerous, but because the Christian explanation of human pain cannot be extended to animal pain. So far as we know, the animals are incapable either of sin or virtue. Therefore, they neither deserve pain, as we do, nor can they be improved by it, as we can. So why does God let innocent animals suffer, and what good does that do? Lewis's answer is profound but hard to summarize. It's that the animals are not their own meaning. They are part of our meaning, our world. In a sense, the tame animal is the more natural animal. And that we are the priests of all creation, and the animals are part of our garden. So they fell with us, they'll be redeemed with us. So somehow the answer to human pain will be extended to the animals. That, in one sentence, sounds kind of strange, but he makes it, I think, quite reasonable in the chapter. He neither is insensitive to the problem, nor is he oversensitive to the problem. Animals are just animals, but they are animals. But the two best chapters in the book are the one on hell and heaven. I've never heard a more rational account and defense of the most undesirable of all Christian doctrines, namely hell, or a more inspiring, short and simple chapter on heaven. Lewis begins the chapter on hell this way: "There is no doctrine which I would more willingly remove from Christianity than this one, if it lay in my power. But it has the full support of Scripture, and especially of our Lord's own words. It has always been held by Christians, and it has the support of reason. If the happiness of a creature lies in self-surrender, no one can make that surrender but himself, though many can help him to make it. If he is free, he can refuse. So, scratch the doctrine of free will, and you find the possibility of hell underneath, necessarily. He says, I would pay any price to be able to say truthfully, all will be saved. But my reason retorts, without their will or with it? If I say, without their will, I at once perceive a contradiction. How can the supreme voluntary act of self-surrender be involuntary? If I say, with their will, my reason replies, what if they will not give in? We are told that the doctrine of hell is a detestable doctrine. I indeed, too, detest it. We are reminded of the tragedies in human life which have come from believing it. But of the other tragedies which come from not believing it, we are told less. People think God is pure love, pure kindness, pure forgiveness. There is no sin that God does not forgive. Lewis agrees with that. Why then is there hell? If God will forgive all sin, any sin, why is there hell? Very simply, forgiveness is a gift. It needs to be accepted as well as offered freely. And a man who admits no guilt can accept no forgiveness. Well, then, what is hell like? We don't know. We're not told very much about it at all. We know a lot more about heaven than we do about hell. Your travel agent doesn't tell you all about the swamps that your car shouldn't get into on the side of the road. She tells you about the great vacation resort that you're supposed to go to. But Lewis has a very interesting speculation. It's purely speculative. Personally, it makes sense to me. He says, we are therefore at liberty, since the two conceptions in the long run mean the same thing, to think of the damned man's perdition not as a sentence imposed upon him from outside, but as the sheer fact of being what he is. The characteristic of lost souls is their rejection of everything that is not themselves. Our egotist has tried to turn everything he meets into an appendage of himself. The taste for the other, that is, the very capacity for enjoying good, is quenched in him, except insofar as his body still draws him into some rudimentary contact with an outer world. Death removes that last contact. Now he has his wish to live wholly in himself and to make the best of what he finds there. And what he finds there is hell. The chapter begins with a quotation from Walter de la Mare's poem, Napoleon. It's a historical account of one of the great tyrants of history, one of the great egotists of history, who moved his soldiers around like a man playing chess. And he's retreating from Moscow. And about 500,000 men are going to be sacrificed to Napoleon's egotism. And he's trying to encourage these dying soldiers, many of whom are freezing in the snow. And he's in his warm carriage. He calls out to them the following encouragement. What is this world, O soldiers? It is I, this incessant snow, this northern sky. Soldiers, this solitude through which you go is I. That's the consciousness of hell. Well, as I say, that's speculative. But it makes sense. Another sentence that says pretty much the same thing is this. If you burn a log, you will have gases and heat and ash. To have been a log means now being those three things. If souls can be destroyed, it's a shocking notion, but that seems to be scriptural. Jesus says, don't fear the tyrant who can kill your body in this world. I tell you who to fear. Fear the one who kills both body and soul in hell. Now, I don't think that can be God. God's work is not to kill. God's work is to give life. He's talking about Satan. Of course, souls can't be destroyed physically. But eternal death, that's a scriptural category. Souls can be destroyed. If souls can be destroyed, must there not be a state of having been a human soul? Lewis is not a universalist. He's not an annihilationist. He believes there is an eternal hell. But what is that human soul in hell? Is it the person that you knew and loved on earth? No. It's something that if you knew it, there would be nothing in it good to love. Is that not perhaps the state which is described as torment and destruction and privation? Remember, in the parable, the saved go to a place prepared for them, while the damned go to a place not made for men at all, but for the devil and his angels. To enter heaven is to become more human than you ever succeeded in being on earth. To enter hell is to be banished from humanity. What is cast into hell, or rather what casts itself into hell, is no longer a man. It is remains. I think the clearest picture we get that in the Gospels is the demon-possessed man, the Gadarene demoniac. When Jesus asked him, what's his name? He can't say I. He's like Gollum in The Lord of the Rings. He says, our name is Legion, for we are many. He's not an I anymore. That is not the popular notion of hell as a torture chamber, but I think it's more terrifying. I think a torture chamber is less terrifying than that, because if it were a torture chamber full of fire, then you could be distracted from this deeper hell by the outer fire. Why do we, when we're in great agony, tear our hair out or smash our head against the wall? That causes pain. Yes, the physical pain is a distraction from the deeper pain. So I don't think this is a milder notion of hell at all. I think it's a more terrifying notion than the external one. But the argument concludes this way. In the long run, the answer to all those who object to the doctrine of hell is this question. What are you asking God to do? To wipe out all their past sins and at all costs to give them a fresh start, smoothing every difficulty and offering every miraculous help, he has done so on Calvary. To forgive them, yes, but they will not be forgiven. To leave them alone then, alas, that is what he does. That's not the last word, heaven is. And if for no other reason, buy The Problem of Pain and read the chapter on heaven 4 or 5 times. He starts by defending it against the common charge of escapism. He says, we are very shy nowadays of even mentioning heaven. We're afraid of the jeer about the pie in the sky by and by, and of being told that we're trying to escape from the duty of making a happy world here and now into dreams of a happy world elsewhere. What's his answer to this? Notice how direct and unsentimental he is. Either there is pie in the sky or not. If not, then Christianity is false, for this doctrine is woven into its whole fabric. If there is, then this truth, like any other, must be faced, whether it is useful at political meetings or not. Then he goes into something very deep. This is his signature thought, really. It's the expression of this deep desire for joy, which some people know is heaven, some people don't, but we all have it. He says, you may think that there is another reason for our silence about heaven, namely that we do not really desire it. I think this is an illusion. There have been times when I think we do not want heaven, but more often I find myself wondering whether in our heart of hearts we have ever wanted anything else. You may have noticed that all the things you really love deeply are bound together by a secret thread. Are not all lifelong friendships born at the moment when at last you meet another human being who has some inkling, but faint and uncertain even in the best, of that something which you were born desiring, and which, beneath the flux of other desires, in all the momentary silences, between the louder passions, night and day, year by year, from childhood to old age, you are looking for, watching for, listening for. You have never had it. All the things that have ever deeply possessed your soul have been but hints of it, tantalizing glimpses, promises never quite fulfilled, echoes that died away just as they caught your ear. But if it should really become manifest, if there ever came an echo that did not die away but swelled into the sound itself, you would know it. Beyond all possibility of doubt, you would say, "Here at last is what I was made for." We cannot tell each other about it. It is the secret signature on each soul, the incommunicable and unappeasable want, the thing we all desired before we met our wives or made our friends or chose our work, and which we shall still desire on our deathbeds when the mind no longer knows wife or friend or work. While we are, this is. If we lose this, we lose all. This secret signature on each soul may be a product of heredity and environment, but that only means that heredity and environment are among the instruments whereby God sculpts a soul. I am not asking now how, but why he makes each human soul different. If he had no use for all these differences, I don't see why he would have created more souls than one. Be sure that the ins and outs of your individuality are no mystery to him. And one day they will no longer be a mystery to you. The mold in which a key is made would be a strange thing if you had never seen a key. And the key is a strange thing if you've never seen a lock. Your soul has a curious shape because it is a hollow made to fit a particular swelling in the infinite contours of the divine substance. It is a key to unlock one of the doors in the house with many mansions. Your place in heaven will seem to be made for you and you alone because you were made for it, stitch by stitch, as a glove is made for a hand. And then immediately after this mountaintop notion, he says, that explains hell. From this point of view, we can best understand hell as privation. All your life, an unattainable ecstasy has hovered just beyond the grasp of your consciousness. The day is coming when you awake to find, beyond all hope, that you have attained it, or else that it was within your reach and you have lost it forever. One of the little extras that Lewis offers is an answer to the question of the meaning of life. Why do you exist? It's a beautiful commentary on a verse in Revelation 2:17, I think. To him that overcometh, I will give a white stone, and in the stone a new name written, which no man knoweth, save he that receiveth it. What can be more a man's own than this new name, which even in eternity remains a secret between him and God? What shall we take this secrecy to mean? Surely that each of the redeemed shall forever know and praise some one aspect of the divine beauty better than any other creature can. Why else were individuals created, but that God, loving all infinitely, should love each differently? And this difference, far from impeding, floods with meaning the love of all blessed creatures for one another, the communion of saints. If we all experience God in the same way and return to him the identical worship, the song of the church triumphant would not be symphony. It would be an orchestra in which all the instruments played the same note. For doubtless, the continually successful yet never completed attempt by each heavenly soul to communicate its unique vision of God to all others, and that by means whereof all earthly art and philosophy are nothing but clumsy imitations, is also among the ends for which each individual was created. That's enough of a sampling. I hope I've motivated you to buy and read the book. Let's ask some questions. Yep.
This issue of hell, I don't know if we ever reconcile, because you hear this from atheists, how could God punish someone eternally for finite sins?
I'll read you his answer to that one. Well, I don't mean it quite that neat, but... Yeah, the question is, here's a typical argument from atheists against the Christian doctrine of hell. How could God punish someone eternally for finite sins? One objection to hell turns on the apparent disproportion between eternal damnation and transitory sin. If we think of eternity as a mere prolongation of time, this is disproportionate. But I think we should reject this idea of eternity, not just more time. Let me give you a reason for thinking that, first of all. We're not quite happy in time, no matter how much of what we've got. We can get bored in time, can't get bored in eternity. And if you've ever experienced any kind of semi-mystical moment, time is totally irrelevant. You don't know if it lasted a second or an hour. Surfers know what I mean. If we think of time as a line, which is a good image, because the parts of time are successive, and no two of them can coexist, that is, there's no width in time, only length, then I think we should think of eternity as a plane, or even a solid. Thus, the whole reality of a human being would be represented by a solid figure. The solid would be mainly the work of God, acting through grace and nature, but human free will would have contributed the baseline, which we call earthly life. And if you draw your baseline askew, the whole solid will be askew. The fact that life is short, or in the symbol, that we contribute only one little line to the whole complex figure, might be regarded as a divine mercy. For if even the drawing of that little line left to our free will is sometimes so badly done as to spoil the whole, how much worse a mess would we have made of the figure if more had been entrusted to us? A simpler form of the same objection consists in saying that death ought not to be final, that there ought to be a second chance. I believe that if a million second chances could do any good, God would give them to us. But the master often knows, when the schoolboys and parents do not, that it is really useless to send a certain boy in for a certain examination again. Finality must come sometime, and it does not require a very robust faith to believe that the intelligence of God knows when. So I think that's a reasonable answer. As I was reading Lewis's quotations, some of you followed them, some of you didn't. That's a good example of what I said earlier, that Lewis's book is this kind of book. It's so tightly argued and well expressed that a lot of it passes you by, like a beautiful train. But when you slow down and take digital camera stock pictures of it, you say, oh, that's beautiful, that's beautiful. Ah, yes. The more you see, the more you admire. Question back there, yeah.
If God loves every human, and yet some of these humans choose to go to hell, doesn't God sort of condemn himself to an eternity of pain, seeing those whom he loves?
That's a very good question, and it's a very hard question. If God really loves you, how can he be indifferent to your damnation? Doesn't that cause him pain? That's also a very good question, because transpose that to the human level and you get the even more agonizing question, You might answer the first question, well, I don't know, I'm not God, I'm sure he takes care of it somehow. But are you quite sure that every single human being you have ever loved is going to be with you in heaven? And if not, how could you possibly endure heaven without so-and-so? Couldn't you say to somebody that you're worried about their salvation, couldn't you say, I can't imagine myself being happy in heaven if I'm walking up and down heaven forever and ever looking for you and you're not there? That's a deeply serious question, intellectually and in the heart. Unfortunately, I think the answer to that question, and there is an answer, is very difficult and very abstract because it forces us to make a distinction between two dimensions of a thing that's very concrete. Abstract thinking is hard. The thing is love. And the two dimensions are the active part and the passive part. The passive part is what makes love able to suffer. You give your heart to somebody, you're going to suffer. Love multiplies all your sufferings and all your joys by how many people you love and how deeply you love them. And there's no way to get the joy without the suffering. All right? But wait a minute. Take a concrete case. Let's say somebody you love very deeply, let's say your son, has just done something really, really bad. Let's say he's got into a drug habit. So you say to him, maybe not in so many words, but really your message to him is saying two things. Number one, how could you do this to yourself? And two, how could you do this to me? And those two things are always together, because you and he are always together. But you can distinguish them. How could you do this to yourself? That's charity. That's self-forgetful love of the other for the other's sake. And the more you love the other, the more passionately you're going to say that and will his salvation. But at the same time, how could you do this to me? I can't possibly be happy unless you're happy. Now, in human love, those two things are always together. They should be together, and they have to be together. But I think maybe in heaven they're separated. Because I think in God they're separated. I don't think there's passive love in God. I don't think God has human emotions in the passive way. I think he has all that's active in human emotion, but I don't think he has passive emotions. Because if he did, then we can act like spoiled little brats who, in order to get mommy to do something that we want her to do, hold our breath until our face turns blue and mommy wrings her hand and say, oh, don't do that, don't do that. We can't do that to God. Can't. Impossible. We can't even say to God, I know you love me, so I'd make you sad if I went to hell. So just to make you sad, I'll go to hell because I hate you. You can't do that. You can't blackmail God. Well, what does he do about it? There are people who say that to him. What does he do? Does he stop loving them? I don't think he can do that. He is love. He can no more stop loving you than the sun can stop shining. But his love is not passive. It's not blackmailable. It's not vulnerable. Oh, then he's a cold fish. No, 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 no. Think of water as if it were love. Now, right now, we're all dry. I wish there was an ocean here. If there would be, I would jump into it and get wet. But I'm not wet. I like to be wet. All right. Falling in the ocean is like falling in love. It's a wonderful experience, but it's a change. It's a time. Something happens to you. You're passive. You fall in love. The water comes over you. You change. So we fall in love. I don't think God falls in love. Why not? Well, there's one thing that can never fall into the ocean and drown. That's the ocean. How could infinite love fall in love? How could absolute infinite love ever get more loving? So to think of God's love as a cold fish is exactly the opposite. It's a volcano. It's a galaxy of total love. It can't fall in love. It's not passive. It can't be changed or pushed around. And therefore, it can't be blackmailed. And somehow or other, God's, I think, going to communicate that to us so that we can be totally happy in heaven, even while we share his purely charitable love of the damned, which they do not come back to us with. They do not reflect. Either he just wipes our memory clean, and that's another possibility, Maybe they're like ashes, as Lewis says. If you've got something very beautiful, let's say you own the Mona Lisa and you're an artist and this is the greatest painting in the world, and it falls into the fireplace and it burns, and now you mourn it. It's only ashes. The most beautiful thing in the world is now ashes. You're sad. But only because you're living in the past. Only because you remember what it used to be. Suppose you're not living in the past anymore. Suppose time is ending and you're only living in the present. Well, it's just ashes. It's not worth worrying about. Those are very difficult notions because I think the problem is solved only in heaven, and we're there in eternity, and eternity is not just a lot of time, and we don't know what it is. We just don't know. It's more than we've got now. So the bottom line is somehow or other God solves the problem, and we only have hints.